Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This summer's protests for racial justice have many Americans rethinking our history and our veneration for certain historical figures. Many of those figures were considered great in their time, but that opinion often doesn't stand up when they are viewed through today's lens. One of those individuals is former President Theodore Roosevelt. In many ways, he was a man ahead of his time, one of our original environmentalists. In 1903, while on a campaign tour for his reelection, he rode a horse to the south rim of the Grand Canyon, where he would speak to a crowd of about 800 people. He had never seen the canyon before arriving for that speech, but that day he told his listeners, "Leave it as it is. You cannot improve on it. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. What you can do is to keep it for your children, your children's children, and for all who come after you as one of the great sights which every American, if he can travel at all, should see." His feeling for and about nature led to his establishing one of the government's great accomplishments, the National Park Service. But Teddy Roosevelt was also a man of his time. Some of his comments and his views don't intersect well with modern-day sensibilities, and that is why his statue was recently removed from in front of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. But we might use TR as a case study on how to regard and treat our ancestors. One way is to consider the whole story of a person. And so this hour we delve into that story with David Gessner. His book, Leave It As It Is, takes readers on a journey through Theodore Roosevelt's American wilderness, and he joins us for the hour from his office at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, where he is a professor and department chair of creative writing. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Nice to have you here. The Trump administration's approach, although Donald Trump has compared himself to Teddy Roosevelt, his approach to environmentalism is hugely different from that of Teddy Roosevelt. Trump seems willing and open to take traditionally environmentally protected areas and open them to moneyed interests, something that was the exact opposite of what Teddy Roosevelt was trying to do. Is that why you wrote this book, to explore the positives of environmental protections, or was there another reason?
It was equal parts fury and love. it was I did want to kind of remind people, kind of shake them by the lapels and say, look, this is our heritage, and we have to save this heritage, and it's being despoiled at the moment. And I wanted to, you know, I've always found that the best way to do that is to get people excited about the land and places. So that was the love part. Trump was definitely one of the inspirations for the book. I was watching other writer friends write kind of knee-jerk responses to what he had done the day before. And I said, I want to take a deeper dive into an issue I care about. And I was already thinking about that because I'll get into it later, but I was involved in studying the Antiquities Act, particularly mm-hmm. Bears Ears National Monument, when on October 27th, which would have been Roosevelt's 159th birthday, 2017, then Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke, standing in front of a portrait of Roosevelt and calling himself a Roosevelt Republican, unsaved or undeclared 85% of Bears Ears National Monument that President Obama had saved 10 months before. And that was really the kickoff for me, where I saw the intersection of what I was trying to write about and cared about in the Antiquities Act with Roosevelt. And I kind of decided at that moment to launch a cross-country trip to follow Roosevelt and work my way back to the Grand Canyon, to Yellowstone and Yosemite. So yes, short version. And by the way, I loved that intro, because I think that's something we all need to be talking about. You know, we're playing amateur St. Peter's, where we're consigning these figures to heaven or hell. We have to start thinking, you know, about, and Roosevelt's a great test case for this, about people who've done amazingly positive and inspiring things, but also have some things that we have to look honestly at and call them on.
Yeah. I want to come back to that Antiquities Act thing that you were talking about, and about Ryan Zinke and standing in front of that portrait, because it's just another indication of how the Trump administration goes about doing their business occasionally.
Very sensitively doing their business.
Trump, as I said, has compared himself to Teddy Roosevelt. He said that he's the same or almost as good. That's a quote.
Right.
And you do. You see parallels between Teddy Roosevelt and his time and Donald Trump and ours. You've said that Teddy Roosevelt showed how one person through their vision, work, energy, and charm could change the country's course, a truth we are seeing through a dark funhouse mirror at the moment. And you say he became president at a time when the mood of the nations was much like the mood today. Remind us of that time.
Well, he, public lands, which is the, you know, the center of the book, were an issue on the rise in the late 1800s, after the Civil War. And public lands were one of these few issues where the right and left, the fractured nation, could come together. And Roosevelt rode in on that, and rode in actually at a high tide of progressivism, not populism. Mm-hmm. And as progressive and inspiring as a lot of what Roosevelt did, you know, he surfed his times in that way. To go back to the comparisons of the two, you know, they're both kind of born with silver spoons in their mouths in New York. They both famously had small hands. It's a fact. And they both, you know, the word bully is so associated with Roosevelt and also with Trump. And I think the fascinating thing is the way their differences define them and the way Roosevelt starts to grow. And throughout his career, he's a grower. Now, he still makes statements that, you know, would have him canceled in a second these days. But you watch this kind of movement forward with progressivism, where he's working for the poor. He's against what he calls the elite criminal class. In fact, one of my favorite metaphors in the book is he writes an essay about walking the ridge. And the ridge for him is the practical ridge between the extreme left and what he sees as the moneyed right. And on the left, what he doesn't like is the dogmatism and the, you know, the impractical love of perfection. And on the right, what he doesn't love is that, what I just said, the criminal, the elite criminal class. And so to watch him walk that line and make mistakes along the way is really a great lesson for right now.
Just the fact that you can use that description of the criminal moneyed elite and the, I guess, the rigidness of the left, about, because we all have litmus tests now on the left, that could be used today. So it's an amazing parallel. The difference, you say, is that through empathy, study, openness, Teddy Roosevelt grew while in office. His was a movement toward largeness, not smallness. He read, he experienced, he liked to go out into the wild and do things. He was a man's man, so to speak. So are you saying that his opinions, his beliefs changed as he was exposed to new ideas? Is that what you're saying there?
Definitely. I'm trying to remember the name. I know his last name is Rees. He wrote How the Other Half Lives. Mm-hmm. When Roosevelt was police commissioner, this author took him down into the, you know, corners of New York, and he saw the poverty there, and he started to evolve. You know, he was such a willpower, pull yourself up by the bootstraps person at first, but he begins to expand, and the Square Deal in many ways anticipates FDR's New Deal. You know, his distant cousin kind of brings those things home. And I say that by the time he ran, by the time Teddy ran as a Bull Moose candidate, he had a platform that would have made Bernie blush. It was so lefty you wouldn't even believe it. And we just celebrated women's right to vote. He was one of the earliest backers of that. He was backing minimum wage. He was backing workers. And of course, his great enemy as he evolved were the monopolies, were the railroads, the trusts. And one of the ways that that could be brought into the present is to think of somebody taking on the fossil fuel industries. You know, if you had somebody who had the nerve, I won't say balls, but the verve and nerve to take on these companies and to articulate why it's important to take on these companies. I think climate change, one of the tough sells about climate change, is making it into a story that excites us and that invigorates us. Roosevelt did exactly that with environmentalism, an issue that basically didn't exist. He created the language. He created the arena in which he's fought for. You know, people looked at him and said, wait, you want to just put this aside and not develop it and not build houses there? And yes, he did. And he told us why. You mentioned children's children. That was a brilliant early move to connect our, to connect the present to the future through a bloodline. And I think he could do the same thing with climate change. So that's why, you know, I call him out on quite a few things, and he deserves to be called out. But I'd love to see him right now, you know, in fighting trim, taking on the fossil fuel industries.
And we will not gloss over some of the things that people have a problem with today.
We can get to those.
We'll get to that. But when he stood on the ledge of the Grand Canyon that day and made that speech, and he was on a campaign tour for re-election as president, as I said, he'd never seen the Grand Canyon, and what he saw was, I guess, not unlike Myrtle Beach. It had become, it had started to become commercialized, not unlike Niagara Falls, and the canyon had not been protected, and there were commercial interests vying for it, etc. It would take 5 years, but he eventually created the Grand Canyon National Monument, which became a national park in 1919. And the phrase, leave it as it is, which he said in that speech, became a battle cry for American environmentalism. When you think of how many people have benefited over the years from the national park system, how many people visit it every year, how do you explain anyone's willingness to diminish it or allow it to be diminished in any way to further encroach on non-protected areas that would cause the loss of that area and also extinction of species? How do you explain that?
Well, to start with, you mentioned Niagara Falls. For early environmentalists, that was the perfect model of what not to do with a national wonder. That was like the do not enter sign that was then transferred to as we created parks. And, you know, it's the generally the resistance that you're saying shouldn't exist in is the mayor in Jaws saying the water's fine, come back in, don't worry about the sharks. It's usually local people who are going to profit from it. The funny thing about the Antiquities Act, and this happened with Grand Staircase Escalante, which is also was also reduced by Trump, in part because I think of the name of the president who saved it, Clinton. But all the surrounding towns have prospered and benefited. So the people who were howling with protest, you know, don't take this land from us, leave us, you know, have now generations later begun to benefit from the saving of the land, which is the standard pattern. You know, we say at the moment there's the howling, often there's howling in Congress, there's howling locally against this saving of land. And then 50 years down the line, they're saying exactly what you said. How could we have ever thought of not saving it? Of course, this takes foresight and it takes thinking beyond tomorrow or beyond the polls that guide the politicians. And this is in short supply at the moment, as you know.
Yeah. One of your areas of concern, is, and you've talked about it a couple of times, is this Antiquities Act. One of his key accomplishments, Teddy Roosevelt's, and I think one that successive presidents have amplified on until now. Talk about the Antiquities Act. What does it do? What was the intent and purpose of it? How has it functioned since then?
There's a pretty long backstory, which we probably don't have time for. I've got to
actually let me stop. Let me stop you right there because I just looked at the clock and we have 30 seconds left, and that's an unfair task for me to ask you to do in 30 seconds. So think about that, and when we come back, we'll get an answer to that question about the Antiquities Act.
Excellent.
David Gessner is our guest. His book is called "Leave It As It Is: A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness," and we'll take a look at Theodore Roosevelt, his good, his bad, and his ugly when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE at 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Gessner is our guest. He's at UNC Wilmington. He's also the author of Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness, which is what we're talking about this morning, particularly about Teddy Roosevelt. The Antiquities Act, which I asked you a question about just prior to the break, He helped put that together. What has it done? How has it functioned over time? And why is it now sitting in the hands of a United States District Court judge deciding on its future?
Well, I won't go into the long backstory, but the short backstory of the Antiquities Act is that anyone who's ever hiked in the West knows that one of the most startling, beautiful moments is coming upon, in the middle of a hike, not in a museum, an Anasazi village tucked under a sandstone ledge. And these were all throughout the Southwest. And of course, people being people, people started taking pots away and started culturally appropriating and on a massive scale, which we didn't really mind that much in the late 1800s, but we minded when Europeans started doing it. America first. We said, no, we're not going to have that. And that was kind of the backstory of how the antiquities came about. It took years. And in 1906, we passed a law where a president, and this is the president's kind of superpower, doesn't have to go through Congress as they do with parks, can put aside land preserving antiquities around, say, that Anasazi village I mentioned, and can save land. And it was passed when Roosevelt was president, and in the language of the Antiquities Act, it says at the discretion of the president, and as I write in the book, using discretion with this president in the same sentence was kind of comical. So right away, he saves Devil's Tower, which was then called Bear's Lodge. It was an Indian sacred land, and we can circle back to that. And that's, we know that through Close Encounters, the movie. And then he starts saving at a more and more rapid pace, and something that causes controversy to this day, saving larger and larger swaths of land, including 800,000 acres at the Grand Canyon, which also, as you pointed out, then became a national park. So this also was a part of the Antiquities Act where it was a stepping stone to national park. You know, you save it as a monument, it becomes a park. But the key thing was, this was something presidents could do. And part of the tradition is they would often do that at the end of their terms, which is what President Obama did in December of 2016 when he saved Bears Ears National Monument. And so Trump trying to undo that and undo Grand Staircase Escalante led to many lawsuits, some filed by Native American groups. And right now, the fate of that is being decided. Imagine if they decided that it was okay for a president to undo what a previous president had done. Imagine the future of hopscotching back and forth. I'll save this, I'll unsave it. I'll save this, I'll unsave it. So this is a bigger issue than a lot of the crises that we, you know, have from week to week. This is taking away the greatest power a president has to save land.
Is that what's at work here? You mentioned he took something away because perhaps because President Clinton had done it, and the Bears Ears Wilderness in Utah, which is a national monument, they want to reduce it in size. I've forgotten the exact number, but it's a substantial number. And President Obama declared that just before leaving office. And we all know the antipathy that President Trump has for President Obama. Is that what's at the crux of this?
Well, a lot of the articles that came out right afterward were about the oil and drilling. But Southeast Utah is actually less fertile in that way, to use a bad word for it. And though they have tried to open it to oil and drilling, the combination of, yes, going against something Obama had done, buddying up to Orrin Hatch, and playing to his base once again, because the people in Utah who are against saving the land are very much in the Trumpian base. So it's a combination of things. And it's also just plays with the general theme of no government interference. You know, people are free, you know, in the simplistic way that leads to the destruction of the land ultimately.
So he made this announcement, or actually then Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke made this announcement on the 159th anniversary of the birthday of Teddy Roosevelt, standing in front of a White House portrait of Teddy Roosevelt. How should we take that image? Because that there's something there. They did it on purpose on that day.
Intention.
In front of that picture. Why are they so intent on reversing Theodore Roosevelt? He was not a challenger to Donald Trump.
Well, people throughout history, presidents throughout history have Nixon quoted Roosevelt as he left office, you know, for the under threat of impeachment. The right and left have all embraced Teddy. It's part of that macho swagger, you know, the cowboy thing. Reagan emulated him. The Kennedys playing football on the lawn were basically trying to recreate the vigor of the Roosevelt years. So everybody wants Roosevelt. So even when he's going directly against Roosevelt's deepest beliefs, he's pretending to be in the Rooseveltian camp.
Yeah.
I should point out, so that we make the turn, because I know we want to talk about it, that after I decided to go, before I did my big trip during the next summer, after Zinke's undeclaration, I did a scouting mission and I went out west. And that's when I started to learn about Bear's Ears. And that's kind of the surprise of the book, which is Bear's Ears was the only, or is still is the only national monument created out of the thinking, planning, and hard work of five Native American tribes who studied this landscape, which was historically a meeting place of these tribes. Each of the tribes has, it's this vast area in southeast Utah where you hike down into canyons, not up mountains. But the Bear's Ears are the two prominent features. And that's where these tribes had met for thousands of years. And so they wanted to use the tool, a U.S. government tool, for a new purpose. And the first woman I spoke to was a Ute Mountain Ute, Regina Lopez White Skunk, who was on the Bear's Ears Commission. And she said, we don't want to relive historical trauma here. We're not trying to say we want our land back. We're trying to take these government tools and save land and save it in a new way where it can be used for ritual, where it can be, where medicinal plants can still be picked. And it was, so all of a sudden this book about Teddy Roosevelt was going kind of sideways on me where, you know, as we can get into, Roosevelt was not the greatest when it came to Native American.
Yeah.
And so that was like, how do I reconcile this thing that's at the core of it with Roosevelt's kind of worst beliefs?
How much area does the Trump administration want to reduce in terms of the size of the Bear's Ears area?
85%. And it splinter it and also turn the names into different tribal names, so to create disunity between the tribes as well.
Is there a reason for that?
Is there a reason for any of this that we've been going through? I don't know. Like, you know, undermining the support of local groups that are against it.
When you look at photographs of the Bear's Ears, it is spectacular. I mean, it's spectacular. It shouldn't be touched. We should go back and quote Teddy Roosevelt again. Leave it as it is. What would happen if the Trump administration is successful in their attempt?
In the short term, not a lot, to be fair, just because it's so remote. But it's got, I mentioned hiking down. I had a guide out there, and we hiked down and down toward the river. And all of a sudden, there were these villages that, you know, had been built when Shakespeare was alive. And there were, or well before that, some of them. And there was this, these petroglyphs. And, you know, this is just sitting out there in the open. And it's been, pot hunters have vandalized it for years. So this is just sitting there unprotected at the moment. But it's remote enough to protect it somewhat. But in the world of Facebook and GPS, people are zoning in on these places and going to find what they can find. So we got to save it. We got to protect it.
When you think about Teddy, when modern people think about Teddy Roosevelt or they read about him, he's almost a caricature of what the real man must have been like, because he's energetic and forceful and rugged and adventurer, bully, that kind of thing, a warrior. But he was a naturalist at heart. And you say that if you had asked Teddy Roosevelt as a boy what he hoped to be when he grew up, he would not have said president. He would have said a naturalist along the lines of Charles Darwin. And on his way to that speech at the Grand Canyon, which he was riding on horseback through the wilderness, and he was able to point out all the birds that he saw. He was able to name them. He could hear the sounds and say, that's that kind of a bird. Where did his interest in the natural world come from?
Well, you know, one difference we didn't point out yet between him and the current president is that he read a Book of Night. And one of the early books he read was Origin of Species. And he found this seal in downtown New York. You know, the fishmongers had it out on a table. They dredged it up. And he started to study it. And he came back and measured it the next day. And he was fascinated by this idea of being a field naturalist, you know, like Darwin. And the real thing that opened his mind up and that I think is crucial to knowing Roosevelt were birds. He goes down a trip with his parents. He's wealthy, of course, and goes down a trip down the Nile and starts seeing all these new birds. And he starts writing about them. And he eventually writes 47 books. And I think his writing and his sentences sprung from birds. And it continues. The crazy thing is, to me, and the thing I still love about him is, while he's president, he goes, you know, hiking into Yosemite or whatever, Yosemite or whatever Trump called it with John Muir. He goes into Yellowstone. He comes running into a cabinet meeting and says, "I have important news." And they all look up and he says, "A chestnut-sided warbler has been sighted, and it's only February." You know, imagine that now. So that's the kind of thing that sticks with him. And the big picture thing with me, and this comes true in Saving Lands later on, is he has lots of prejudices of his time, but he doesn't have one major prejudice, which is anthropocentrism. He sees beyond the human. He sees that he's a hunter, but he eventually sees that saving the big carnivores and the big ecosystems is absolutely vital for the for this country to remain vital.
During that re-election campaign, I think in 1903, he embarked on a camping tour. He traveled hundreds of miles through the wilderness. You have to remember, there were no interstate highways back then. They were barely cars, and there were no gas stations. So he's out there in the middle of nowhere, taking trips by train and car and camping out in North Dakota, leaving his Secret Service detail behind as he went on an excursion in Yosemite. That you say will be, quote, long remembered as perhaps the most famous camping trip since Jesus spent his 40 days in the desert. you took that same trip. Is that correct?
Yeah, I followed it.
Why was that important?
Well, I'm a writer. I don't like the phrase nature writer, but I write about place quite a lot. And I've found that knowing people, you know, I don't consider this a biography, more of a biographical adventure. I lean on a lot of great biographies in it. But I find like being in a place that meant something to a person, and certainly the Badlands, for instance, my first stop, rung some kind of chord in Roosevelt. Being in that place is a way to know the person. So when I went on my big trip following Roosevelt, I left with my nephew from University of North Carolina, Asheville. He's 21 years old. He just graduated. And we went up the East Coast. We went to Sagamore Hill, his house on Long Island, where my nephew kind of shook his head and said, "Too many dead things." We went to Harvard, where Roosevelt was. We started heading west, and I was playing, you know, Roosevelt speeches and books about Roosevelt. And my nephew was so sick of Roosevelt by the time we got to the Badlands. He never wanted to hear the phrase manly vigor again, right? But then we got to the Badlands and we woke up and saw buffalo outside our tent. And then we went on to Yellowstone, where, as you pointed out, Roosevelt had famously said, "No press, no Secret Service. I'm heading into the wilderness," in the middle of a campaign tour with John Burroughs, and, you know, studied elk and studied birds. We went to Yellowstone. We went to Yosemite. And finally, you know, we went to the Grand Canyon as well. So it was this kind of knowing the places as a way to know the person in part, and also because it was really fun.
So we painted this wonderful picture of Teddy.
All right, let's get after him.
Yeah, there's another side that we have to talk about. Yeah. So if environmental protection was one of his good characteristics, his racism was the flip side of that coin. You have said that up until the Civil War, Americans thought of wilderness as being virtually synonymous with the place Indians were, Indians being Native Americans, indigenous people. After the war, as Americans pushed west, America's indigenous people were no longer seen as part of the wilderness. They were seen as being in the way. And you say that even though Native Americans had long-standing hunting grounds on what became Yellowstone National Park, Roosevelt saw that activity as encroachment. And in his lifetime, he often said things about Native Americans that would be repugnant to most of us today. So how do you explain his ability to learn and evolve with the juxtaposition of these antediluvian ideas he had about Native Americans?
Yeah, I don't. You know, one of the things I try to do, and maybe if I were writing a true biography, I would, because I've noticed that biographers tend to make, you know, excuses. They've been spending 8 years with this person and they, you know, they've kind of fallen in love with them, and or they move briskly on. And I kind of try to just let it lay out there. And what I lay out is, in recent years, there have been a couple books, one by Mark David Spence called Dispossessing the Wilderness, where it talks about how America's best idea, which is what Wallace Stegner called the creation of national parks, maybe has some darker underpinnings. And those darker underpinnings are mainly, as you said, that the land that we're saving and the idea of our pristine wilderness is land that was used for thousands of years, maybe longer, because we found out this summer that the inhabitation of this country is perhaps double what we thought it was. And these were hunting grounds and places. And so maybe there's something a little less fantastic about national parks. And ditto with Roosevelt. If we give him credit for being prescient about environmental issues, we have to realize he wasn't just of his time, but behind his time in some ways, in terms of his attitude toward Native people.
Was he a white supremacist? By today's standards and today's language.
Sure. I mean, but you have to understand that this white supremacist was inviting Booker T. Washington to the White House, was creating laws that were embraced, got a glowing eulogy from the NAACP. You know, he was a messy, complicated, hypocritical person, certainly by today's standards, particularly some of the things. We don't really have time to get into the John Muir controversy, but I'll just say that the phrase that everybody uses when he says dirty Indians is in a journal entry about some Yosemite Native people who come up to him and try to sell him tobacco and liquor. And by the end of the journal entry, he's questioning himself and praising them. So, you know, it's cherry picked out of there.
We'll come back and talk about many of those things you just mentioned in a moment. It's our conversation with David Gessner, the author of Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Gessner is our guest, professor and chair of the Department of Creative Writing at UNC Wilmington and the author of many books, including the one we're talking about this morning, Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness, a timely book and a timely conversation because right now, Americans are struggling to come to terms with their history and with historical figures who thought differently than we do today because, lo and behold, we evolve as societies. Our ancestors had vastly different ideas about a lot of things, and today we often find those things offensive. As you traveled in Teddy Roosevelt's footsteps, as you became more familiar with everything he said and everything he wrote, I know that you became increasingly troubled by some of these attitudes that he possessed. You say that Native Americans had no place in his America. They were obstacles to be pushed aside, yet you still wrote a book about him. Why?
Well, I think that, as you say, this is he's really kind of a perfect figure to think about right now. As we take down his statue, rightly, because if you look at the statue, he's standing, he's on horseback, and on one side there is a, you know, nearly naked Native American, on the other there's a nearly naked African man. The museum, in a compensatory gesture, has also renamed its Hall of Biodiversity after Roosevelt. And this, to me, is the vital issue of our day. And I still think there's much to be taken from him. But as we said earlier about him being behind his time, he embraced Manifest Destiny when Manifest Destiny was already 50 years old. And his Trumpian qualities really were, you know, I don't know that Trump actually believes in making America great. He believes in making Trump great in some twisted way, but Roosevelt did believe in that. And he thought kind of as the shining vision, and really did create what we, for better or for worse, what we consider kind of the modern superpower. But he, as he imagined, you know, us moving to the other coast and taking all that was there for us. And what happens to him in his life is that the if you cherry pick these things out, you can come up with an awfully ugly, not just white supremacist picture, but a bad one. Yeah. I mean, not that white supremacists are bad. You can make a pretty dark vision of the man, but he's always complex. And even his attitude, say, he went out west to ranch. By the end, he's abhorring a lot of ranching. He sees it as a big monopoly where cows are taking over land that wild animals should be on. Hmm. And he's always kind of surprising you with the turns he makes.
Well, he saved land and he saved wild animals, but he had very little regard at the time for the humans who had inhabited that land for centuries. In 1886, he said, "The most vicious cowboy has more moral principle than the average Indian in today's world." Then in his book, The Winning of the West, he wrote, "The truth is, the Indians never had any real title to the soil." Well, talk about a Western European point of view. And as you mentioned, he was the first president to invite an African-American, Booker T. Washington, to dine with him at the White House. But he was also the only person, the only African-American he invited to dine at the White House, because after he did so, he got a lot of pushback in the press and in society at large. He also oversaw this unjust and dishonorable discharge of 167 black soldiers in Brownsville, Texas in 1906, despite his knowing of the soldiers' innocence. And Michael emails, "Jim Crow was implemented during Teddy Roosevelt's administration. What, if anything, did he do to stop it?" So in today's world, he does not pass the so-called litmus test. And in today's world, if you can't pass that litmus test, you must be cast aside.
Right.
All right. So we're trying to balance this equation. Is there a way to balance this equation? Is there a better way to deal with culture's evolving attitudes and not toss out everybody who came before, because we will be tossed out ourselves in 150 years.
Right. And I might be tossed out if I come rushing to his defense right now on this radio show. So, I have to just say, like I said, I let things sit next to each other, you know, discrepancies, hypocrisies. For instance, he also said, "This country will never be mature until it has a Jewish president and a black president." He said Negro president in the parlance of the time. He also, and this is one that really is dangerous, because we're talking a lot about how individual good behavior doesn't forgive institutional racism, but he became very close with the Native American members of the Rough Riders. And later he tours the West and goes down into Hopi Kiva, and he never quite gets beyond the idea of assimilation, but he learns a lot about the culture. And unlike a lot of people, you know, studies the culture and brings that into the discussion. And certainly, I live in Wilmington, where in 1898, 2 years before Roosevelt ascends, we had our famous coup, and all those repressive laws are starting right around then, you know, as this kind of backlash. So yes, that's there too. So it's a messy thing. And I just want to say that it sounds like you want to ask a question, though.
That's okay. I was just going to say, Michael wrote about Jim Crow taking root in the Roosevelt administration, the Teddy Roosevelt administration, and what, if anything, did he do to stop it? Did he push back at all on that, having had Booker T. Washington to dinner at the White House?
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you look at the platform of the Bull Moose platform, it reads, like I said, it reads like a current, almost too liberal for Mr. Biden platform. And so he does start to, at the same time, he's friends with people who were considering eugenicists, eugenics at the time. I think like one thing that we used to do regularly is cut people slack. I mean, we didn't say, we didn't expect people before Newton to be discussing gravity. You know, we used to just kind of say, let's try to put ourselves in their place. And a simple test is, how would you do then? I have a friend who will go unnamed, who's, you know, spouting Black Lives Matter stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, if you put this guy back then, this is, it would be ugly. Let's just put it that way without being too mean. And then taking somebody from that time and putting them in our time. And I think a reader of books, someone who had gone through, who would have then gone through World War II and seen the results of that, the slaughter, would do quite well right now in terms of progressivism.
Speaking of progressivism, he, as you say, his platform, some of his positions would make Bernie blush today because they'd be more progressive than Bernie Sanders, and it certainly wouldn't make its way into the Biden platform. He helped lay the foundation of the modern Democratic Party. As an example, in August of 1912, he made a speech outlining ideas that not only still resonate today, we're still talking about them today, and we're still fighting about some of these ideas. He said it was no longer acceptable for people to work under conditions that are injurious to the general welfare, and he called on industry to submit to regulations that would improve working conditions.
We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation. The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living. A standard high enough to make morality possible, to provide for education and recreation, to care for immature members of the family, to maintain the family during periods of sickness, and to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
These were revolutionary ideas back then, and they could have been spoken yesterday, but in fact they were recorded by Thomas Edison in 1912. That was Teddy Roosevelt speaking. So he was an anti-corporate crusader. Following the publication of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, he passed laws for clean meat because that book was a horror story about our meat supply in this country. He championed conservation. He won the Nobel Peace Prize. He inspired the teddy bear, and he saved football by bringing members of the fledgling football leagues to the White House to find ways around the carnage that was happening in football, the injuries and the death. Should all of those accomplishments somehow offset the negatives that we've been talking about?
Let me take this in a little different direction. I didn't come to Roosevelt to judge Roosevelt. I didn't even come to write a biography. In a weird way, I came to use Roosevelt. And what I mean by this is I had a great professor in college, Walter Jackson Bate, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Samuel Johnson, who talked about biography being a great art form as a reader, as well as a writer, because of what we could put to use in our lives, what we could come to and find. So when I went to Roosevelt, I was thinking about how I could become an environmental fighter, not how I could become a racist, not how I could become a white supremacist. And I was looking at these qualities and thinking, this part is inspirational. And, you know, I'm not going to throw out Teddy with the bathwater, basically. Now, as it turned out, the way the book evolved was kind of fascinating. I guess it's wrong to say that about your own book, but I will. In that Native American proposal for Bear's Ears that Obama implemented was basically taking the draft that Roosevelt had made of his conservationist manifesto. He'd given us a rough draft from 120 years ago with some problems in it. And it was taking it and revising it for our time, which is exactly what I was trying to do with the book. I was saying, look, this guy is far from perfect. There's some ugliness here. But he did create this thing that if it's not America's best idea, it's a pretty good idea. So let's take it now, throw out the bad parts. I mean, it's indicative that the very first national monument was Devil's Tower, which had been sacred land, Bear's Lodge, and that the most recent one is, you know, Bear's Ears, which is a whole world apart because one grew out of Native thinking. So my thing was, let's take what he did and give us a new vision that's relevant to now, a more inclusive vision of nature, a more less touristy spectator version of nature. And let's try to do something with it because we need it. It's our Noah's Ark for climate change. We need to keep this public land. It's a bigger issue than all these things that we see every day on MSNBC and Fox that we think are the biggest issues. Yeah. It's our future, basically. For our children's children's children.
So Nelson on Twitter says, yesterday's world is not today's world. It never will be. Civilization changes. And like every human being to have ever walked the earth, including you and me and President Trump, he is, Teddy Roosevelt, was a walking paradox. He had empathy for the disadvantaged, but not for Native Americans. He was an avowed trust buster who accepted the patronage of banks and corporations. He was one of the world's foremost conservationists, and yet, as you pointed out, he slaughtered hundreds of wild animals because he was a hunter. Should we then just say he was a human and excuse the contradictions?
Yes. And in terms of using him, as I mentioned before, he was a very contagious human. You know, one thing that I point out in the book is that he started the day with a big cup of coffee, and he drank it throughout the day until, as Edmund Morris put it, he energetically went to sleep. He coined the phrase, good to the last drop.
And did one of the really? Things,
yeah, he, that's what Maxwell House used. He coined almost every phrase, it turns out, you know, throw the hat in the ring, you know. So, you know, to me, it was like I had written 10 books about how much I love nature. And I was like, okay, you love nature, but it's time to put up or shut up. It's time to become more active and make a stand more. And so what better figure in terms of that? I'm certainly not going to him like, you know, if I talked as much as he did, he was called a Gatling gun of conversation. That wouldn't be a good thing to emulate, but maybe the taking a stand and being bold is something that I like to emulate.
He was a man of many firsts. He was a man who thought of things before other people thought of them and then brought them into being. And you bring up an interesting question about preservation, and one that most of us, I think, don't consider. We just take for granted that these national parks that preserve these pristine areas of the continent have been here forever, but they haven't. And you ask, what if parks had not been created? There was no obvious reason that they should have been. Yellowstone was preserved by Ulysses Grant in 1872. Teddy Roosevelt would go on to create the National Park Service. So who should get the credit then for creating this piece of wealth in America, this national park system?
Well, there are all kinds of misconceptions, one being that Roosevelt invented the Antiquities Act, or that, you know, he created all these parks. He couldn't create them without Congress. But he certainly made it his top three priorities during his term and most of another term. Conservation was one of them. And conservation was something that nobody had heard of. And it was a big, bold idea. And I write in the book about how the current big, bold idea is connecting parks. The line of the conservationists is islands are where species go to die. Well, parks are where species go to die too. So in the West, like the Y2Y is the Yellowstone to Yukon initiative, they're starting to create kind of migratory rivers, including overpasses and underpasses over highways and under highways where large carnivores can migrate. And Roosevelt didn't go to Yellowstone to see Old Faithful. He was bored by that. He went to see the big animals. And even though millions of people visit Yellowstone, they're only visiting a small, 2% of the park. 98% of the park is plenty wild right now. You have mountain lions, you have wolves, and you have bears. I mean, and that's still there, and we're lucky for it.
And he created the park system not to go camping, but to preserve this wildlife and these large animals. Very quickly, I have maybe 15 seconds. If you could be the arbiter of how we should remember and or honor Theodore Roosevelt, what would you say about him?
Messy, hypocritical, prejudiced of his time, but still worth emulating in ways, particularly when it comes to the biggest issue facing us, climate change and preserving land for the future.
David Gessner is the chair of creative writing at UNC Wilmington, and his book reads like that. It's a wonderfully florid book about Teddy Roosevelt. Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. Thank you for the Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.